supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. A fundamental human drive is to be known for who we are. And so we tell our story. We tell it to friends, family, therapists, all with the same goal, to be known. All memoirs tell the story of who we are, how we've suffered adversity, or how we've experienced something different in our lives, or maybe how we've reclaimed what we've lost. And why do we read them? Almost as important as telling our story, we're endlessly curious about others. And all of this is an effort to connect. We are a social species, and our brains are social organs. It's all in an effort to connect with one another. And on today's show, we'll ask, what's at the heart of these life stories? How does memoir writing take shape? How does it shape who we are and how we feel about ourselves and others? And when does writing about our experiences have a therapeutic value? I'm joined here in the studio by writer Beth Kephart, author of the new book, Handling the Truth, on the Writing of Memoir. Beth, welcome to Voices.
What a gorgeous introduction, and thank you for having me here.
Thank you. We're also fortunate to have social psychologist James Pennebaker. He's written about how keeping secrets can make people sick. He's discovered how people can improve their physical as well as mental health by writing about their deepest secrets. Jamie, it's great to have you on the show.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Beth, so like I said, we have a fundamental longing to be known for who we are, understood, accepted. Do you think that's the driving force behind memoir?
I think that's one of the driving forces behind memoir, but I think we also have the fundamental need to know how we connect to the rest of the world and whether our story is similar to stories of those around us. And I think memoir is a bridge in both directions.
Why do you write memoir?
I've written memoir in the quest to answer very specific questions. For example, my third memoir was about how well I could ever really know my husband, who was born in El Salvador. And so the book is about the country, the coffee farms, but also marriage. I believe that real memoir is organized around fundamental universal questions.
Such as?
Well, that one there, with Ghost in the Garden, I was looking at how we grow into middle age gracefully. With Seeing Paz Z, I was looking at, can we really give our children the freedom of imagination?
And when you say we, you mean Beth?
I mean Beth as a woman who is like many other women.
Sure, sure. Jamie, in your research, you've found that writing one story contributes to physical health as well as emotional health. That's really interesting to me. So what actually happens, and why does it happen when people put emotional experiences in writing?
Well, this gets to the larger question you're asking. I'm not sure that writing's value is necessarily to be known. It's more to know oneself. And in our research, what we do is we have people write about emotional upheaval, sometimes for 3 or 4 days in a row for only 15 or 20 minutes. And what happens is when people are given the opportunity to do this, they write and they come to understand that the upheaval better, how they reacted to it, how it has touched their lives in ways that they hadn't thought about it. And I think this exercise in getting people to know themselves better and to understand their situation better helps to kind of essentially quiet their mind. They're later able to sleep better. They're able to connect with other people better. They're able to listen to others better. It makes them more, for lack of a better term, more centered.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions around the clinical nature here. I'm going to be selfish and talk therapist to therapist here for a minute. What's curious to me is the research around trauma. The recent research shows that, you know, our original idea was to talk about it over and over would help. And now we're finding out talking about it over and over actually harms and you know, it actually makes it worse. So well, what you're describing is something very different.
Right. I think it's important to stand back and look at the various research projects, and they actually paint a fairly similar picture. After a major upheaval, in the first hours or days or even weeks afterwards, getting people to process that is probably harmful. It's not beneficial to talk about it, or I think even to write about it immediately afterwards. Mm. It's too painful. And if you look at how healthy people deal with traumas, they often distance themselves in the first days and weeks afterwards. However, if, say, a month or 2 months or a year afterwards, the person is still thinking about it, obsessing about it, worrying about it, that's when putting it into words is so beneficial. And I think writing is a particularly effective way, but I think talking can be a very effective way as well. So it's not that talking per se is bad. It depends on the context.
And it depends on the timing. I would imagine writing then helps somebody literally get it out of their head and on paper.
Or I don't like that metaphor very much. I think it's more it helps them to organize it. It helps them to put it together. And I think writing does that in a particularly efficient way.
Beth, you talk about what memoir is not.
Yes.
Could you tell us that?
Yes, and when I talk about memoir in this book, talk about memoir as art, memoir to be published, which is different in many ways from just writing down what happened to you. Memoir is not. I do begin the book that way. And just a few thoughts. It's not a chronological, thematically tone-deaf recitation of everything remembered. It's not a typeset version of a diary scrawl. It is not exhibitionism for exhibitionism's sake. It's not an accusation, a retaliation, a big take that in type. It's not a lecture or a lesson or a stew of facts. It's not a self-administered therapy session. It's not an exercise in self-glorification. And it is not a trumped-up fantastical idea of what an interesting life might have been, if only. It is not a web of lies.
You just destroyed Facebook.
Good. I've had an impact.
When I think of the memoirs I've read, I've written, much of the story, like much poetry and music, is about, and picking up on Jamie's theme, is about where we feel broken or wounded or maybe more to the point, alienated, where we've had an experience that made us feel cut off from our species. Is that your understanding of it also? I mean, if it weren't for that, what would we write about?
Oh, I think there are bigger stories to tell. I think those are important stories to tell. Those stories are often told in memoir, but there are stories of travel to new countries and places that shake your idea of what's important in the world. It's really about bearing witness to the world and your role in it. And sometimes we come to the world as broken people, and sometimes we come as curious people. And sometimes a memoir is as filled with research as it is your own personal story. And I think there are infinite storylines and a smaller, much smaller number of questions to be pursued. It's about hunting down the answers so that all of us benefit from the story told.
What do you see as what's happening inside of you that needs to have a voice or wants to have a voice?
Oh, that's such a complex question. I blog daily, and it is my way of kind of knowing who I am that day at 4 in the morning when I get up.
We got to talk about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I want to know how I'm perceiving and how that perception is changing over time, how the books, the worlds, the friendships, the experiences I have are shaping the way I see. I want to know how compassion is building in me. I want to understand what I'm capable of.
And you know that by reading it, by putting it down.
I know it by shaping it in my head and pulling together disparate metaphoric bits and actual experiential bits. It's a weave.
It sounds like you and Jamie are coming together here. Jamie, this sounds very similar to what you're doing or what's happening with the people you're working with.
Actually, the way Beth describes memoir is it's very, very similar to this expressive writing. The one difference is expressive writing, I think of as private as opposed to memoir. But almost everything else that Beth is suggesting is very, very similar. And it's a journey trying to understand yourself. And it's fascinating, having read hundreds, probably thousands of essays that people have written. I would call what they write is art. It is a part of them. It is central to who they are.
I think what you two are talking about is really fascinating, but I want to be able to see it, feel it better. So let me start with you, Beth. So what are you talking about really? I mean, what does that look like, finding yourself through writing, finding your compassion through
Okay, I'm going to take one particular book, Still Love in Strange Places, which took about 15 years, was a novel. It was very deeply researched. My husband is Salvadoran, grew up in El Salvador. When he is in his country, he's a very different person than he is when he is here. And so I wanted to know, how well do we ever really know the people we've come to love? In order to get at that, I researched even the geography and the creation of the land that is El Salvador, the history of coffee in El Salvador, all of these pieces that come together to help me understand who he is, who I was when I was there, and how we go forward together. It's tangible. It's landscape. It's weather. It's food. It's not just that I, that pronoun I, that says, if it is just that, it isn't memoir. It may be essayistic, but it hasn't been shaped. It hasn't been fully considered as art. And in Handling the Truth, that I teach at the University of Pennsylvania, I see these young people at the verge, on the verge. I love my students. And they are all pursuing important questions. They've gone through a heck of a lot already. And I love teaching memoir to that age in particular, because I feel like it helps them pivot toward adulthood.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about memoir, writing down your story, whether it's memoir or whether it's a private narrative. We're talking about both, putting yourself down on paper. We're with author Beth Kephart and social psychologist James Pennebaker. Jamie, you're...
Could I ask Beth something? I'm curious, do you also do writing that's just for yourself? And how does that differ from... I'm presuming the answer is probably yes. How does that differ from the writing that you eventually publish or post?
I do all kinds of writing, actually. I write about place for my local Philadelphia Inquirer. I write young adult novels. I write poetry. And these books about truth and the blog. And then I also write for Corporate America. So I'm using different kinds of language all of the time. And I do write a lot that I don't show anybody, but it's all toward the making of something that I will ultimately show someone. So it's a free form, throw it on a piece of paper. What does it look like? Where's the one interesting word or detail at the very beginning? It's layers before I show it to people, with the exception of that early morning blog post, which maybe sometimes I shouldn't put those up, but they go up.
Jamie, why do you ask?
Well, I'm curious, because there's some topics that I know I wouldn't want anybody on earth to read about. And I'm curious if there's sometimes there are certain topics that you can't write about because they could hurt others' feelings, or that they show a side of you that you don't want to announce to the world. What I'm getting at is because I also, like you, I do a lot of different types of writing. But these private times, I find for me to be particularly, I guess, helpful. And they help my other kind of writings as well, in terms of just a kind of emotional gain or something.
There's a very different approach to the page when you know no one's going to look at it. And so I understand exactly what you're saying. I don't tend to do that kind of writing for myself. I only did that when I was a young mother and wasn't really publishing and just wanted to put some thoughts down. I am interested in the making of art and in the interweaving of the personal with the global. And with history, the rub of then against now. So it's a very artistic pursuit, and I want to make it something worthy of others' eyes.
Jamie, I want to ask you, before we take our break, the same question I asked Beth. Give us a sense of the process when you're working with your patients or students of how they shape their own stories, their own understanding, and the changes that take place.
It's probably helpful just to give a little bit of background. I'm not a clinical psychologist, and I started this research almost on a fluke. I had discovered an odd phenomenon, and that is people who had some kind of traumatic experience that they kept secret were far more likely to have health problems than people who talked about these traumatic experiences. And that led me to wonder, what if we brought people in the laboratory and had them write about upheavals in their lives? And when we did that, I didn't know what I was doing. I simply brought in a group of people, and half of them I had write about superficial topics for 4 days, 15 minutes a day. And the other half, I asked, I want you to write about the most traumatic, upsetting experience of your life. I want you to really let go and explore your deepest emotions and thoughts around it. And a little bit more. But I had no idea what I was doing. And I discovered that having people write this way brought about health improvements. They went to the doctor less. They went to the student health center about half the rate as people in our control condition. And over the years, I discovered that first of all, when given the opportunity, people naturally write about really profound experiences. And across the board, people in our studies would come and they'd thank me for letting them be in the study. And the other thing that was so interesting is some of these people would later be in my classes, and they were, frankly, a lot of them were pretty lousy writers. But when they were writing about their own personal story, they were beautiful. They were artistic. They really expressed themselves in ways that really touched me. And I feel that when we're able to go to that place to be honest with ourselves, we do make art. We do put together a story that is meaningful and I think ultimately beneficial.
I think that was beautifully said, and I appreciate that, Jamie. When we come back from our break, I want to hear about the computer program that was generated that where you were able to analyze the content of their writing. That's endlessly fascinating. More when we come back. You just heard from James Pennebaker. He chairs the Department of Psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. He studies language, emotion, and social dynamics. He's written a number of books, including Writing to Heal, a guided journal for recovering from trauma and emotional upheaval. I'm also joined here in the studio by author Beth Kephart, who's written 5 memoirs. She teaches creative nonfiction at the University of Pennsylvania, and her new book is called Handling the Truth on the Writing of Memoir. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about memoir, putting our stories down on paper and seeing what that does for us, what we can learn about ourselves. My guests are author Beth Kephart and social psychologist James Pennebaker. So, Jamie, before our break, you were telling us about your discovery with these trauma victims who, when asked to tell their stories in as much detail as they could, they got healthier, physically and emotionally. I want to know about the computer program that I don't recall. Was it you or one of your students developed?
This is a computer program I built together with one of my students, Martha Francis. And one of the questions I had after we discovered that writing had these powerful effects was, what is it about writing that makes a difference? Can you look at what people have written and identify healthy writing from non-healthy writing? And the answer turns out that humans can't do it. We tried over and over again to see if we could do that. So we ended up writing a computer program called Linguistic Inquiry and Word Count, LIWC, which we pronounce Luke. And it took a few years to develop, but we can go into any given text, and it will calculate the percentage of words that are emotion words and cognitive words and pronouns and articles and all various things. And what we started to discover was that people who benefited, who showed health benefits from writing, used language in a way that many ways I wouldn't have predicted. And one was, the people who benefited the most were people who constructed a story over time. Having a story isn't healthy or unhealthy, but making a story is. Very often the people who would come in and they had some kind of upsetting experience that they didn't understand, over the 3 or 4 days of writing, if they moved to a more coherent story, their health improved.
Give us an example there, Jamie.
A person on the first day writes about unexpected death of his father, and he kind of describes it and talks about his emotions, and his writing is powerful, but it's not particularly coherent. And then the next day of writing, he starts putting it together in terms of what was going on with his father beforehand and what was going on with him and his relationship with his father. And this continues, and by the last day, he's starting to have kind of a broader overview of what the death was, what it meant, and what the implications are for his own life. So he's moving from kind of a chaotic group of experiences to a more coherent story.
And that's without guidance, coaxing, guidelines?
Absolutely no guidance. And that was one of the things that also impressed me, is people, I think, are their own best therapists. And as I said, I have no clinical training.
You're not supposed to say that. Come on. I'm trying to earn a living here.
Exactly. But I realized that I was starting to sound more and more like Carl Rogers, who said a very similar thing, that people are actually quite adept at figuring out their own problems, and I felt as though my job was simply to give them permission to start digging and figuring out what was going on.
We recently did a show, Jamie, on secrets. And one of my guests, and I was surprised by this, talked about how important secrets are for boundaries, for privacy. But as a psychotherapist, and you know, how destructive they can be. You found in your earlier work, when you realized that secrets can make people sick. So what's your take now on secrets?
I agree with both sides. Our secrets are necessary, and they're socially required in life, but that they can also be destructive. So for a very good example, I've dealt with many people who have had, say, were molested and by a father or stepfather. And some of those people kept it secret and they had major health problems, and others told their mother, and the mother ended up blaming the child. And in some cases, the mother kicked the child out of the house. And it's a very interesting problem. There's some evidence to suggest if you tell a secret and you're essentially punished for it, that's probably worse than if you didn't tell the secret in the first place. These poor people are put in this terrible double bind, and you can see why sometimes secrets are the lesser of two evils.
Hmm. What's your take on secrets, Beth?
Well, telling a secret in a book can hurt a number of people. And it can also, one has to really think about what one puts in a book. Our work is interesting because Jamie's thinking is about the healing of self. And I think, Jamie, by the way, I've read 43% of The Secret Life of Pronouns so far. And I will finish the other percentage there. So I'm really enjoying it. Actually, as a fiction writer who thinks about how boys should talk, it's really very helpful. So you should get to that at one point. But I forget where I was going with this. Secrets. When you put something into the pages of a book, you are binding that secret into the pages of a book, and you are exposing it to many people who may not help you heal by knowing that it exists. Books freeze people in time. They freeze problems and unresolved things in time. And there's a great danger in not being able to look forward and ahead. I write about that a lot, and not a lot, but somewhat in Handling the Truth, because there must be cautions taken, as I like to say.
I think a lot of people, and Jamie, I'll toss this over to you, a lot of people keep secrets out of shame, out of fear of being exposed. Now, I'm not talking about the people who might literally put themselves in harm's way, but most of us who keep secrets, we do it out of shame or fear of shame. And I have found personally and professionally that when shame is kept in the dark underground, it festers, it rots, it decays. And the only cure I know for shame is exposure to sunlight, the same way with mold.
I would temper that a little bit, and this is where I really love writing, because I think when a person is able to write about these shameful events and just put it on paper, in my experience, a very high percentage of people do that, and they realize it's not as bad as they thought. And in fact, we've done studies in the past, and we find that it depends on the study, but 30-40% of the people afterwards will start telling people about this shameful event that they had kept secret. But I think so much of it is you have this shameful experience and you never write it down, which means, and you never tell anybody, which means you never really process the enormity of this event, and that putting it on paper allows you to, first of all, acknowledge that it happened, and secondly, allows you to start to put it together in this broader framework of life of how this affected my relationship with this person, how it influenced my financial decisions, how it affected my career decisions, God knows what. So I think putting it to light is correct as long as we define light as putting it on paper. Making it public, and I think Beth is exactly right, making a secret public might be good for you or me if I'm doing it, but it also depends on your social environment. Some people can't handle it. Some people are going to you may be ostracized because of it. Hmm. Everything you feared.
Beth, last year I taught a couple of workshops on memoir writing, and like Jamie with his research, I had no idea what I was doing, but I enjoyed it. And I said to the group, I said, why are you writing this story? Where is it coming from? Who is your audience? Who do you really want to hear this story? And to what end? And I told my story verbally. I took about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, just told my story in a boring chronological way, like you said we shouldn't. And I said to them when I was done, I could have told that story 1,000 different ways. And I could have taken any one element of it and written a book, a memoir, about any one element. So why did I choose to tell it that way, and why to you? So why do we do that? What is that a process we should or do engage in before we put pen to paper? Or
yeah, you absolutely have to know why you're telling your story. If you're writing with the hope, again, of being published, which is different from what Jamie teaches and thinks about and studies, it is the hardest question to answer. I'd love to know how easily the answers came from your students. It is what I work on quite a bit with my students. One of the things that I start with, which seems like it might not be related, but I ask students to write what they expect of the writers they read and what they expect of themselves. And it is the first step in a long sequence of steps that helps them define what they're doing and why. How are they going to measure what they're doing? How will they know if they're doing it the best that they can do it? And by setting expectations as a reader, as a writer, early on, first early step, there are many in handling the truth. I'm looking at all these small incremental ways one steps toward finally knowing what your book is about. You don't know what it's about when you start writing. Mm. You write it 500 different ways, and then you find that compelling narrative that binds you, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, not just to you and your own family story, but to the broader world. Memoir, published memoir, does not, in my humble opinion, have a real role in this world unless it is also speaking universally to someone else. It is here as a published piece for someone else and not ultimately for yourself. If you publish memoir just to make yourself feel better or to feel somehow validated, you have gone about it in all the wrong ways.
Hmm. And these days it probably won't be published anyway.
Depending if you self-publish.
But you know what, Jamie, let me ask you one last question before our break. You know, Beth talked about must address some universal truth. And I would imagine with all these essays you've read, all this writing that you've read, I'll bet they all address some universal truth.
I'm depending on you, Jamie, to have the right answer.
No, I'm sitting here thinking, I can't begin to answer that question, partly because we get into some kind of ugly philosophical knots about what a universal truth would be. So, well, for example, if I write about liking broccoli, is there a universal truth to that?
No.
Well, no, it. I bet we can.
But if asparagus were involved, it'd be fine.
I guess the reason I asked you that question, Jamie, is because, you know, our show's about two-thirds over, and you've disagreed with me three times. So I thought I'd just, you know, bust your whatever and ask you an impossible question. But on a serious note...
But
you know,
he's still smiling, Jamie.
Everything I've written, you know, addresses themes that I consider universal about the nature of suffering, the longing of the human spirit, the need to connect, you know, the voice of the heart, what we all have in common and you know, where we're different and where we're the same. These are the universal themes, you know, and I would imagine anybody who writes from the heart has to address these themes. And, you know, Jamie, you're having people write from the heart and not from the head.
But, you know, the reason I guess I stumbled on that question is when I write and I'm trying to deal with, you know, an upheaval in my life, I'm writing about me and my situation. And, you know, if I stand back, I could say, oh, yeah, I guess other people have dealt with this. But when I'm writing it, I'm not thinking about the world.
No. And I'm not talking about that as a goal or as an agenda. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the deeper you go inside yourself, the more you connect with the rest of your species, even if the surface story is different. We've got to take a short break. We'll be back in 60 seconds. My guests are Beth Kephart. She's written 5 memoirs. Her most recent is called Handling the Truth on the Writing of Memoir. James Pennebaker chairs the Department of Psychology at the University of Texas, Austin, and his most recent book is called Writing to Heal, a Guided Journal for Recovering from Trauma and Emotional Upheaval. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about writing, telling your story, its value, what's private, and what is public in your life. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY FM.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about memoir, or broadening it out. We're talking about writing your story with author Beth Kephart and social psychologist James Pennebaker. Before our break, Beth, we were talking about starting with a storyline and winding up with universal truth. You've got one of your students who you quoted in the book?
Well, I do have many students in the book, but I quote actually from 100 or so memoirs that I love. I'm going to just read four lines of me talking about what memoir is. Earlier in the conversation, we talked about what memoir is not. And then I'm going to give you a very brief example. So, first, me. Real memoirists open themselves to self-discovery and in the process make themselves vulnerable, not just to the world, but to themselves. They yearn and they are yearned with. They declare a want to know. They seek out aloud. They quest. They lessen the distance. They lean toward. What do I mean by that? There are examples all throughout the book, but let's take Jeanette Winterston in Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, her wonderful memoir. Listen to how she uses, and Jamie, I know I was wishing I had your Luke while I was looking at this, but So listen to how she makes her personal quest something that that includes and embraces us. These are her words. Listen, we are human beings. Listen, we are inclined to love. Love is there, but we need to be taught how. We want to stand upright. We want to walk. But someone needs to hold our hand and balance us a bit and guide us a bit and scoop us up when we fall. Listen, we fall. Love is there, but we have to learn it and its shapes and its possibilities. I taught myself to stand on my own 2 feet, but I could not teach myself how to love. That is the framing for the entire story that she tells. She doesn't tell a chronological life story, this happened and then this. She frames her story inside that need to fall and to learn how to love.
Hmm. I want to talk about this process, how we begin the process of learning to write. Beth, you said some things that intrigued me about the process you engage in and you teach in your book. One of the things you advise people who want to write is to get out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting to me.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. For every single imaginable reason, because when we dwell too much in ourselves, we forget we cannot evaluate how difficult our situation actually is until we lean beyond ourselves with empathy and compassion. So we have to see, we have to research, we have to take photographs. I also walk. I walk to find the rhythm of the story. I, in fact, right now I'm taking an enforced hiatus from writing except for the blog because I felt that I had become too narrow in my own perceptions. I'm not going to be able to write in an engaged way if I'm not fully engaged. So, yeah, get out of the house. And if it just means sitting in the back and watching that bird that you didn't realize had come back to its nest, it is about cataloging color and weather and landscape. It is about seeing beyond yourself. It's that I pronoun. Hang it on the hook of the world.
Say that again, that I pronoun.
It's the I pronoun, and I'm just saying that it has to be hung on all the details of the world that are around you, the music you hear, the things you eat, the song that your mother sang to you. Your story will remain too small to be inspiring others in a big way unless you push out, connect, bring it in, and play with language in unexpected ways.
Yeah, I speaking of language, Jamie, I love the title of your book, The Secret Life of Pronouns. And, I saw the title and I'm thinking, oh, now pronouns have secret life. I'm going to read an autobiography of a pronoun.
You have no idea.
I thought when I first began reading your book, I thought of what the Buddha said. You know, the Buddha said, if you can summarize all my teachings in one sentence, he said it would be disavow everything that begins with I, me, or mine. And I think what I heard Beth saying, or maybe I'm going to superimpose this, is to make I, we, and then come back again. To play with those two pronouns when I becomes we. And I know that might not work for the people you're working with now, but it intrigued me about this pronoun thing. And that's one of the things you learned with your computer program was about pronouns.
You know, pronouns are not, they work in ways that surprise you. And the use of the word I very often is actually a marker of being personal, self-reflective. When you are talking about your feelings, your perceptions, I is a marker of looking inward. And it's often, I think, ironically very healthy. Obviously, living there is similar to becoming ruminative and depression prone, but my sense is many of us don't use I in enough, I in the way of being self-reflective, of stopping, and I think of Beth's image of being in the backyard and seeing that bird that you is going to its nest that you weren't aware of. But being in that place where you can look inwardly and thinking about the last time I was here, or not looking at yourself in this broad way of I'm seeking glory, I am the greatest, but rather how I'm feeling. And so ironically, use of I is a, it's okay.
yeah, it's, you're right. We don't use I enough in ordinary dialogues. I mean, you know, in my practice, I hear, you did this to me, you shouldn't do that, as opposed to saying, when you do that, I feel hurt, or I feel scared, or I feel abandoned.
Exactly.
So you're right about that. I want to, speaking of language, Jamie, in one of your studies, you looked at the language of love, something you called style matching.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the language of love sometimes silence?
The language of love is often silence, but it's also much of the work that we did was looking at young love, of when two people are first meeting one another, when they first start dating, when they start spending time with one another.
Mm.
And one of the best markers is that two people who are engaged with one another use language very, very similarly. We call it language style matching, or LSM, we call it. And we actually can predict if a couple will still be together several months later at a shockingly good rate, and much better than the people themselves, by just looking at how similarly they use language. And once they start diverging in the way they talk to one another, that's an interesting recipe for problems, that they're not listening, that they're not paying attention.
Well, I got to tell you, that's really interesting and weird. You know, you know, I like
that.
That's
why I have a job.
I got a question.
The life of a research scientist, man.
Yeah, it's so
really
great.
I'm going to just write that down.
I like what he
I'm
said.
I'm blogging that one.
I like what he said about his research. He was said twice, you know, I went in there and I didn't know what I was doing. And I'm thinking, well, that's what therapists do every day. I mean, so I've got a question about a study you did of Al-Qaeda communications, videotapes, interviews, letters at the request of the FBI. What did you find?
Well, one thing, I've done a lot of work with various groups, and one is you can get a sense of a group and the way it thinks by the way that the people use words. It's not particularly surprising. And how that leader, for example, connects with the people in the organization, and how it's setting up a person's identity. One of the things that we have also been interested in is, can you predict if an individual or a group is going to behave hostily, if they're making threats, or what threats are credible and which aren't? Can you tell this by the way people use words? And the answer is we do a pretty good job, not a perfect job by any means, of predicting, say, attacks. Or we even see this on our own side. When a leader changes in the way he or she uses language, certain shifts predict, say, aggressive actions, mm-hmm. going to war, things like that.
That's really, really interesting. Beth, I want to ask you about the way you described yourself.
Did I describe myself?
You did describe
yourself.
One of the ways.
What did I say, Jamie? What did I say?
One of the ways you described yourself. Described yourself as an introverted young girl who wrote poetry.
Yes, years ago.
A girl who was the popular girl that boys confided in and sought counsel with about the girls of their dreams, but you were never the girl of anyone's dreams.
No, I was not.
P.S. That's my story too. But, but so
that's why we're on radio and not TV right
now. So, tell me about how that experience informed your life and your writing?
I think that every writer comes from a place of seeing themselves, whether or not it's true, on the margins, and it forces one into a contemplative and an observant mode, and it deepens your own resources. You have to be capable of dealing with an entire day on your own, for example, and so you have to be endlessly imaginative, and I think brave. I wrote a young adult novel that was very much based on Beth as a high schooler at Radnor High. And I think, though, that it also makes me really compassionate and probably a pretty good teacher, because I can look around a room and know who might be struggling to be there, and I'm not going to let them struggle. I won't let that happen to them.
So, Beth, we have 60 seconds left. I want to ask you a simple question. What's your mind like?
What hour of the day are we speaking of? I am balancing always many different sounds and ideas, and I'm anxious often. I am someone who wants to make use of every minute of the day, and I love deeply. And I am privileged, I feel like a privileged person, to be able to do what I want to do and to work with students who I love. I just heard from three of them today, very quickly. One's just going to publish her first book. She's 22 years old. So, yeah, you know, I love I have a very big family of students.
And, Jamie, we've only got a couple of seconds left. Can you tell us what it's like there? You sound like you have
a
good
easy,
time.
It's easy, Jamie. Go for it.
You have a good time.
It's easy. You know, I have a glorious life. The world, partly because the world is just so exciting and interesting, and I enjoy it. And I've been fortunate in life, and I'm also not a very anxious person. So I've...
Well, Jamie and I are going to come out there and see you for therapy, whether you're a clinician, Beth and I, whether you're a clinician or not. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time. We've been talking about memoir and therapeutic expressive writing today with Beth Kephart and James Pennebaker. Well, please comment on today's show or listen to other shows by going to whyy.org/voices. You can follow us on Twitter at Voices in the Fam, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. And Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You're listening to W.